the tabletop. Take away
game mechanics on display.
Three designers share the stage.
Pick a genre and we'll play
the tabletop. Take away.
Welcome back to the Tabletop Takeaway. I'm Trevor Muller-Hagel.
I'm Ananda Gunaratna.
And I'm Charlie McCarron.
And today we are finishing up our interview, Getting to Know Your Podcasters series, which is really exciting because we're going to have questions from the Discord as the interview questions for the three of us. You guys excited for this? This is going to be fun.
Yeah. I thought we got some good questions. So, and this is a little like shameless plug to join our Discord, right? Because maybe in the future you'll get to chime in on.
Plus, you just hang out with us and chat and ask questions to our little community that's developing, and mm-hmm. it's a great group of folks so far. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I enjoy it.
So yeah,
well,
Trevor, do you want to lead us off with a very serious, important game design question?
Yes. So, you know, we're a group of game designers, and we really want to know all these really important questions about game design. So. Starting off with a question from Harrison Dunn. Who would win in a fight, Shrek or Donkey Kong?
I mean, I'm pretty sure it's Donkey Kong, right?
Shrek is an ogre.
Donkey Kong is like a gorilla.
It's true.
He's obviously much stronger than Shrek.
He does seem bigger than Shrek, potentially. It depends on which Donkey Kong we're looking at, though. The original Donkey Kong that's, you know, before Mario? Maybe. He's throwing barrels. He's doing all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. I will say that Donkey Kong was my character in Smash Brothers.
Oh, 64. Okay. Maybe a little biased.
So I am biased.
Is Shrek even in Smash Bros? Nope. Can't even make the cut.
Maybe my greatest, to tie it into fun game design moments, like when I realized in Donkey Kong 64 that you could grab someone and then pick them up and walk with them.
Yeah.
That was a highlight of childhood video gaming when we all just played. And none of us realized you could break out of that, but we just grabbed each other and
just jump off
the edge. Yeah. So.
Great. So moving on from the serious questions, this is going to come from Juggler3702. What genre, mechanic, style of game do you find most challenging to design?
I mean, I think for me, it might be social deduction games.
They seem simple on the surface, but it's tough.
Yeah. There's an extremely fine balance that you have to strike with social deduction games, I think, between information and ambiguity. If you have too much information, the game is solved. If you don't have enough information, then everyone's just going on vibes, which some people seem fine with, but I don't find that fun at all.
It's not very compelling. You could just draw some cards and someone's bad and find them.
Yeah, like, so the big challenge with social deduction games is getting that balance just right.
Mm-hmm.
Like figuring out how much information you can give players, how ambiguous you can make it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get it wrong, then depending on how long the game is, it can be spoiled very easily. Because somebody realizes the truth and is able to prove it.
Like when, you know, you're playing One Night Ultimate Werewolf and someone's the seer and sees that the two will, or like, who, you know, they know who the wolf is, the werewolf.
Yeah.
And like, oh, well, they're the werewolf. Like, oh, no, I'm not. It completely shatters the experience for a moment.
In that case, there are things you can do in One Night Ultimate Werewolf. Like discrediting the seer, of course.
Right.
But it depends a lot on your ability to convince people in that moment then.
Which means that it's not dependent on the game design itself, but more dependent on the players. And so having a good metric in the design, like Blood on the Clock Tower, where, you know, the demon gets to like have information about what's not in play so that they can fake something very easily.
Yeah.
That's really nice. Thing, in my opinion, for social deduction games.
Yeah.
I think mine most challenging would probably be tactical combat games.
Oh.
I think more because I'm not a huge fan of most tactical combat games. And
it's like my favorite genre.
Yeah. I don't know. For some reason, maybe it's...
But you love chess.
I do love chess. We did put that in tactical
combat. We did put that in tactical combat.
But you're saying as a designer.
As a designer, yeah, maybe it's that... I don't know. Yeah, I don't find like balancing games very fun to design. Like where you're thinking about stats a lot and like, ooh, this unit should be this so that when we have this battle... I don't know. I guess I haven't really tried it, so
it's intimidating. That's
challenging, yeah, in that sense.
I would probably lean towards deck builders and making them fun and engaging, but not copy something that already exists, because there's so much out there already. And trying to, like, I tried to do a deck builder for a while, and I had a really hard time being novel and still have enough familiarity with the system. To like, I could not strike that balance really easily. I still really want to make a good deck builder, but all of my deck builders have become different games since then. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's move on to the next question here. This is from Kenny Z3513. At what point in the design process do you start considering the arc for the game, and how do you craft it? This is a very apt
question. It's a good question. Kenny.
Yeah.
It's
very abstract and very can be difficult to answer potentially, but
I think it's a great question to ask yourself as a designer.
Yes. Because
often I don't think about the whole game arc.
Yeah.
And I think like thinking about how the game ends is really important. Like what's yes. the feeling you want players to have at the ending? What have they been leading up to something? Mm-hmm. Or is it like the punt version is, oh, the game ends after 10 turns and right. then count mm-hmm. your points.
Yep.
I guess, thank you for the question, Kenny. I guess one thing that I think of, not so much, I don't think so much about the arc explicitly, but rather about what's changing over the course of the game. Mm-hmm. Because if there's nothing changing, if you're doing the same thing again and again, and there's no progression, then the basic unit of play is wrong. So it's so like, in my mind, the basic unit of play in a game, what feels like a complete game, is dependent on the duration over which something important changes.
Okay.
And at different level, this may be different at different levels of the game. So like, if you look at, for example, Slay the Spire, right? Mm-hmm. Within a combat, you're playing cards, and some of the cards, so let's look first at one turn of combat. Mm-hmm. You play a bunch of cards on the turn. Some of the cards do damage, some of them block things. And then at the end of the turn, the cards go away, and you get a new set of cards, which is kind of a change. Over the course of a whole combat, you're getting a little bit more powerful, right? Mm-hmm. You're playing power cards that give you passive bonuses.
Improve your engine a little bit.
Right, improve your engine. Maybe you're trashing some of your cards. So the character of your deck changes a bit over the course of a single encounter. Mm-hmm. And then zooming out a little bit more, over the course of many encounters, in between each one, you're adding more cards to your deck.
Right.
And so because at every level there is progression over the course of that level of play,
yeah,
it feels like a complete game. But if, for example, you were playing Slay the Spire and you never added any new cards to your deck, you just started right. with a deck and just played that deck again and again
Sentinels
and again.
Of the Multiverse, like if you had that kind of style of deck and then you're just fighting different threats right. all the time.
Yeah. It would not feel, it would feel like a succession of small play sessions stitched together. Mm-hmm. And if you enjoy the game, that's fine, but it doesn't feel like a coherent game as a whole.
Yeah.
So I guess when it comes to the arc for the game, I just want to make sure that, you know, at every level of play that the players might be paying attention to, something is changing in a
You're
in
having a ramp up in some way.
Right. And yeah. I think that leads naturally to an arc if you make yeah. sure that something is changing over the course of the game.
Yeah.
In Sprocket Forge, mm-hmm. For example, with my own design, You're gaining new gears over the course of the game, but you do also sometimes trash gears.
Mm-hmm.
But because you tend to level up over the course of the game, I do feel like there is enough progression there.
Sure.
And in Toaster Tactics, the game I'm working on right now, there's progression in that you're buying new stuff to add to your robots, and the mm-hmm. stuff that you buy is always yours. You never lose it, so you never go backwards in progression. I think that's important to never go backwards in progression.
Yeah. Yeah, and just to throw it out there, in Dungeons & Dragons, they used to have negative levels from creatures, and it was the most frustrating thing because, like, it could take you a few sessions in those later levels to just gain a level, and that's, 12 hours of work then, and you just lost it. It's like, oh, what?
Yeah.
What? Yeah, so I'm pretty sure they removed it. I haven't looked at all of the monsters in 5th edition, but I'm pretty sure that's not in there anymore because that's just brutal.
Yeah, you never want to take away progress from players. That's not good.
For me, I start considering the arc probably around the point that I know that the system is working, because I always do, like, make sure the core of the system works. I don't have an ending normally when I start. I just want to know how the play works, if the play is as I imagined it, or if it's, if there's anything I can easily change to make that better. And so the arc starts to come through, and then I try to adapt the game to kind of player expectation of, like, oh, yeah, I think we should have been done, like, 5 turns ago. It's like, oh, that's far, much different from what I imagined. Okay. So then I start kind of figuring out where the arc should be based on that kind of feedback from people.
Cool.
From Rabid Angel, we have, how do you know when a design is finished? Whether it's now ready for pitching, selling, putting on the shelf, etc.
Well, okay, I suppose one answer to this is that a design is never really finished.
Right.
But as you go through playtest again and again and again, at some point you get to a point where your notes have very little in the way of changes that you feel that you need to do. And at that point, you kind of have to tell yourself, okay, let's stop here and, try to figure out what we want to do with this, mm-hmm. whether it's publishing it or shelving it.
Mm-hmm.
But continuing to work on it is probably not going to be productive because we're not seeing any more changes here.
Right. If you're just changing one number on one card in like a deck builder or something, it's like, well,
right.
Okay, this could probably be moved along.
Yeah. So if you're good about taking notes on playtests and what changes mm-hmm. with each playtest, you will eventually start to see the delta between versions get small enough that you know it's time to stop.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for me personally, I've been really bad about giving myself like a goal or an endpoint for my design. And I think that can be really helpful. Like as soon as, you have the design in your mind and you're trying to get it in that direction, once it starts to take more or less that full shape, then I think it's time to like carve it away, get everything kind of buttoned up to how you imagined it would be. And does it work? Do people enjoy it? Is it really enjoyable or not? Then you kind of use that as a metric, like, okay, do I shelve mm-hmm. this? Do I pitch this? Like, am I really still excited about this after putting who knows how many hours into the development of it, right?
Yeah.
And it's really hard, when we do have a lot of time sink into a project. It's like, well, we have to publish it now because we spent so much time on it. We have to publish it. It's like, oh, no, don't do that. Like, shelve it for a while if it's not getting great feedback from folks. But, just having the determination to publish the game can mean that you have it and then you print it and then no one buys it. And I've had a few friends in the past that have done that. And it's really, they've both stopped designing after mm-hmm. that because that just tanks your entire motivation and your bank account, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, I think of like, different stages of finished, like, okay, this is finished enough that I want to make a how to play video rule book polished and then pitch it and then like leave it with publishers for a while. And I have a bad habit of changing games like continuously if I keep thinking about them. So I almost have to like, okay, maybe it's out to publishers. I'm intentionally going to stop thinking about the game so that I don't want to
keep spinning the wheels and
Because, you know, maybe sometimes publishers are like, well, we like that version, so why would you change everything about it after you sent it to us? So, yeah.
Exactly.
But yeah, a lot of times, I have a lot of games that just got put on the shelf, and yeah, it's fine to leave them, and sometimes they come back when you think all hope is lost. Wait, there's something inspires you. Again,
this should be drafting.
Yeah, like you listen to an episode of the Tabletop Takeaway, and you're like, "Wait!"
Or you record an episode of the Tabletop Takeaway.
Yeah, I could bring this back from the dead.
Yeah, I mean, as far as putting things on the shelf goes, I think if you don't feel excited about the game, put it on the shelf.
Yeah,
even if it's something, well, I guess okay, if it's something that you think would be very easy to get published, maybe try that. But like, if you don't, if you're just not feeling the game anymore, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
You know, find a different game to work on that you're excited about.
Yep. So from Captain Zacavius, Monopoly is featured on the Toy Story ride in Disney World. What board game do you think would make the best amusement park ride?
So I guess I'm not sure what the implications of this would be for safety-wise, but
we can ignore safety concerns. That's
yes,
fine.
All right. Let's ignore safety concerns and assume they're very good engineers who and lawyers and so forth working on this. But I think it would be super cool to have a Galaxy Trucker themed ride. So what I'm imagining is you have like a bunch of pre-built modules that the people on the ride can snap together to build the ride
and
themselves.
Then sit in.
And then they sit in the ride, and then the ride goes and you know they get to pilot the ride based on the modules.
Perfect.
And their friends in the other habitation modules get broken off, and you're like, wait, who gets to...
I'm imagining something like a gigantic bumper cars arena, like just a really big one.
Oh, my God.
And so everyone builds their spaceship, and then you get into your spaceships, and you go and...
Bump into each other. Parts fall off, and then they have to get cleared.
And there's maybe there's foam on the parts so that if you run over someone, it doesn't hurt them.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that...
Well, hopefully people aren't on the ground. That would be the key.
Right,
so they stay in their seat, and their module just goes spinning off.
Maybe they have, like, I don't know, cameras or something that will... an emergency shutdown for the ride if it looks like someone's about
but
to
now
be,
we're concerned about safety, and we don't want to be concerned about safety. We're only concerned about fun.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it could be a water ride. The ships could be on the water.
That's my idea, though.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
No, well, okay, so I was looking at my game collection, and I thought that the best might be Captain Sonar. And you're in subs, teams and subs, and, you know, playing out Captain Sonar. You don't know exactly where they are, and then you surface. And
next
then
to each other.
You see, like, oh, they're over there. Okay, go back down. Yeah, maybe it's like a maze. Maybe it's not actually water, but you're like... navigating a maze and trying to
are there any amusement park rides that do involve being in something similar to a submarine?
Having people underwater for a ride might be a liability issue.
Maybe.
I mean, that's
we do a lot of other things with people in amusement parks, so maybe not.
That would be so fun.
Yeah,
just being in an underwater ride. Wouldn't that be...
there's got to be something.
There must be, but I've never seen any ride like that.
Well, whoever's out there designing theme park rides, let's make it happen.
Yeah,
Captain Sonar.
I'm struggling to find... my first thought was Ticket to Ride. That would be just a very boring game going across a country. But ride.
It could be like the kiddie ride.
What if the people build the tracks?
What's the video game we played?
Unrailed,
yeah. A real-time Unrailed. Real live-action Unrailed.
It could be the trolley problem.
I think there might be more liability concerns with that one.
Oh, no.
I think there's a trolley problem game, isn't there?
There is. It's pretty morbid.
Yeah.
It's great.
Cyanide and happiness.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. All right. So next one is from Tobias. If you could wave a magic wand and change, remove, or add any trend in the board game industry, what would you change? I would want to see, like, maybe a more prevalent, like, leaning towards a genre. And I know that's kind of abstract, because we normally have that anyway. But, like, when we had the zombies, when we had fantasy, like, they tend to follow these things. But right now, it feels like there isn't a really strong pull towards any specific theme or type of game. Unless I'm wrong and I'm just not in the industry as much as I used to be. But I'd love to just see, like, a new, like, aliens or... like, just something that just everyone's like, oh, that's a great theme right now. Let's all do this type of game. And then you can really compare them and have this whole adventure going through the different types of games of the same genre.
Yeah. It does feel like every theme has a game.
Yeah.
You really got to stretch
How
it
many
now.
Ninja games are there, though?
It says we can add a theme. Or
yeah, you
add
can add
a trend.
Trend.
We can add a brand new trend.
Yeah.
Even if we're not. Not sure what the trend
logical are. Induction games are just a hit now. Just have that be the thing.
Actually, yes. I would love to see a trend of more logical induction games.
Perfect. I had a feeling.
I think that sounds like a fantastic trend to add to the industry. I think there's probably a lot that can still be done with them. You know, creative things, especially like integrating them with other genres, like in Alchemist, where it's a logical induction game, but it's also a worker placement game.
Oh, sure. Involve it more like sub-games of games, so like it's being used more throughout
the
games. Yeah.
Right. I think it's cool because it's fun to figure things out.
Mm-hmm.
And
feel clever.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would add more logical induction games.
For me, I think maybe more games that are, more popular to play games that are just, like, in this world or games that don't require actual
components
maybe.
Sure.
It'd be cool to see if that would catch on a little more. 'Cause, like, some friends who we always think about these random games to play to occupy our parties. And it's like, we don't necessarily need to buy a game to do that. But it's just like,
wouldn't it be cool though?
Just more wacky variety of games like that.
And things that are useful, like in this world is genuinely quite useful.
It's fun and has a high utility, which is kind of crazy.
We need more games that are also useful tools.
Yeah.
Games that teach us things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like music and how to make it. I've been thinking about that because of the Turbo Deck.
Yeah.
Card decks. And it's like, maybe for game designers out there, like maybe you have a field that you do that's not game design. Likely you are doing something else. So, like, what is that you could teach people through your own game?
I did actually, when I was doing freelance theater stuff, I thought about making a freelance game where you would learn how to be a freelancer in kind of any industry. And just how you get contacts, how you get jobs, and then that's like the whole game. And then the game Freelancers came out and had nothing to do with any of that. I was like just adventuring, getting loot and stuff like that, which I thought was really fascinating.
Well, here, second answer sort of to that is like educational games. Like there's a good potential for a lot of game designers to have work doing educational games, but it's like sort of a separate world to get into. I'm still not exactly sure, other than I have met some teachers who've been like, hey, could you design a game for this class?
Yeah,
sure, I'll do that. But it's always like a one-off,
right?
Where it's like, how do we break in with like game design skills and teacher skills combining somehow to like make really good
That'd be pretty cool.
Games.
Yeah. Where it's not just like an educational tool, but they actually, like, in this world, they enjoy doing it and they discover it along the way, right?
Yeah.
Educational games are difficult because people always are drawn to whatever will make them win at a game. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you have something like In This World, you don't win at that. So that's a little bit easier. But if you can't just have a game and put fun facts on the cards, that doesn't work.
Like Wingspan.
I feel like the probably default option that teachers who maybe aren't as familiar with games might just go to, like, well, let's play a trivia type game.
Sure.
Yeah. Answer. But teachers are very creative and often game designers. So,
yes.
Like, yeah, we know a few that make games.
Speaking of which,
hey,
Pete 55104, who is a teacher,
Peter Ratzloff.
Yep. Hey. What are your top three games right now, and how do they compare to your top three games 5 or 10 years ago?
Hmm. I'll start it off because
great.
Peter and I just were judging Cardboard Edison games, and one of our top ones was a real-time game I think that's a difference in my tastes. I've grown to like real-time games a lot more than I expected.
Because
there's something like really just inherently fun about the timer on a game.
Yeah.
It depends on the kind of game. Like, I really did not like Escape. That was my first intro to real-time games.
Escape the Cursed Temple or whatever?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not a bad game. It's, like, pretty fun, but...
The rolling dice, then you get locked, and then it's like, oh, God, I can't move. Yeah, someone come help me. It's like, no, we have to get out of here. It's like, oh, God, okay.
To me, that's just a stressful game.
It's a very stressful game. I enjoyed that one, actually, but...
Yeah. But, like, there's... I guess because I play chess now too, like, I appreciate the timer and chess is probably my top game if I was going to count all games.
Sure.
But yeah. What do you guys think?
How did that compare to what your tastes were 10 years ago? Let's say 10 years.
I didn't play chess that much.
Okay.
And
real-time games were just not even
on the radar? Yeah, I'm trying to think. I don't know if I 10 years ago probably very few real-time games in my mix of
I don't think I played a single real-time game back then. But 2015 that would have been
Galaxy Trucker, I guess.
Galaxy Trucker was, yep.
Captain Sonar, maybe, if that was 10 years ago.
I think that was more recently.
I guess let's see. It's hard to remember what games I was really into 10 or even 5 years ago. Right now, if I had to pick top three, I guess I'd probably just default to the ones I've played the most in the last year or so, which would be Blood on the Clock Tower, Spirit Island, and maybe Root. I'm not sure what the third one would be.
Sure.
So, you know, those I think are all quite good, and they're sort of moderately long, not super long, not super short. Ten years ago, I think some of the games that I was into were Mage Wars, Dune, the board game.
Sure.
Heroes of the Storm, which is not a board game, it's a video game. And those are, I think, a bit longer than the ones I like today.
Okay.
Dune, of course, very, very long. Mage Wars can also be quite long. And Mage Wars is very complex.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of setup. Like, outside of the game, there's a lot of preparing your decks of cards to play the game. Whereas Blood on the Clock Tower, Root, and Spirit Island, they're relatively quick to set up, they're reasonable amount of time to play, and there's no outside metagame in the same way.
I think for me these days I've been really into, I just this past few months I got the Elder Scrolls Betrayal of the Second Era from Chip Theory Games, and I think they knocked it out of the park with having a kind of short form campaign RPG in a board game form. I really enjoy it. It's really interesting. The combat's really dynamic because all the monsters have specific abilities that you have an easy reference sheet that you can look things up. But yeah, it's just very dynamic, and it has the ability to just kind of go with your kind of as you explore the world and as you go to different cities or towns, it adapts to that a little bit. Not intensely, but like it feels like a different game each time you play it, and you can do several different kind of campaigns in the game. And so I've just been really impressed. And each campaign is only 3 games long. So you're not like signing up for a 50-game Gloomhaven or something like that or more. So it's not a huge time commitment, and you could just maybe even bust through it in a day if you really wanted to. Outside of that, honestly, I really dig Three Sisters. Mm. The Roland Wright.
Yeah.
Just the exploding of actions that happen. I know it kind of overwhelms, but it was so interesting.
Cool.
Yeah, I've played that several times with multiple different types of people, and that's been a lot of fun. And then, honestly, Spirit Island has been a big one that we played, and I've played a couple other times as well. And I would love to learn it better. I have a simple version of it, but I haven't had a chance to play with other people yet with that. So, yeah, I'd say those are my three right now. Dominion was a big one back in the day, maybe over 10 years ago. But Dominion and Catan were definitely staples, and Munchkin. So, like, those were kind of my staples maybe 15 years ago, not 10 years ago, but...
Yeah, Dominion for me was... I was playing every week at least twice a week for, like, a year or two.
Yeah, it was so great.
I will say one thing that does occur to me, though, is these days a much, much higher percentage of my time is taken playing prototypes, both mine and other people's, than it was back then.
Yeah,
I mean, I was playtesting things a bit back then, but nowhere near as much. And these days, you know, I say I play Blood on the Clock Tower and Spirit Island more than other games, but honestly, I don't play them anywhere near as much as I just play prototypes. That's most of what I do these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So next question is another from Harrison Dunn, maybe a more not... Shrek versus Donkey Kong question. If you could design and publish for any IP, which one would you choose and why?
Any IP?
IP.
Oh, wow.
I think I would pick either some from my childhood, either Redwall.
Redwall would be great.
Or Dinotopia, where people are like riding dinosaurs and it's just a... Both have maybe had, or Dinotopia has had a game, I think, but I don't know if it was any good. But yeah.
Love it. That'd love it. So when you said Dinotopia, I immediately went Animorphs. I don't know why.
Nice. Okay.
Unless, like, if you could have, like, everyone's human, but then they could transform into, like, asymmetrical creatures that could do different things.
Yeah.
To solve different puzzles. I was just like, oh, that sounds like a fun time.
for non-millennials who don't haven't read Animorphs, the key selling point was that the whole book was also a flip book in the corner. You could see the human evolve into the
creature.
Animal.
Which is also the cover of the books of them just changing shape into whatever creature it is.
I mean, okay, you say that's the key selling point, but I read them as a kid.
Yeah.
And I remember them being quite good.
Yeah.
Okay.
And maybe if I went back now, maybe I wouldn't be as interested, but...
I loved them.
I thought they were very good.
Yeah. Like, I think they had a TV show too.
I thought
they may have had a short-lived TV show, but maybe I'm imagining something else.
But yeah, I was very into Animorphs as a kid. I read all of the books. I owned most of them, and yeah, I thought they were pretty great.
What would an Animorphs game be? We didn't answer
sure.
There have been many Animorphs games.
That makes sense.
I have played some of them.
Video games?
Video games. Okay. I think it could be cool to do something a little bit like XCOM. right?
Oh, fascinating.
I mean, Animorphs is about...
A tactical RPG about Animorphs.
Well, it's perfect. It actually fits perfectly when you think about it, because first of all, thematically, it is a story about fighting off an alien invasion.
True.
And not only that, but one of the... Okay, so one of the weird things about XCOM, kind of weird thing, is... Yeah. You know, you're this organization fighting off an alien invasion, and you go one skirmish at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, well, shouldn't you be fighting them in multiple places at the same time?
Right.
Can you really fight them off one place at a time? But the whole story of Animorphs is about a tiny group of teenagers fighting off the Yerk invasion one mission at a time.
Right.
Like, they're only a couple of people. They're only a handful of people. They can't be in multiple places, and each book is... them doing a specific thing.
Yeah.
So it would fit very naturally into the feel of the story to have a game where you go and have a series of missions where you control your Animorphs and have them fight the aliens. And then, you know, you can have fun morphing technologies and abilities and whatever.
But, and then improve them with an RPG element. Yeah.
And you know, it's kind of asymmetric in an interesting way because the aliens have ranged weaponry and you probably do not.
Yeah, you're an animal or a human.
Right, you need to make use of stealth. But then you can, I mean, all of your characters can also, of course, acquire the enemies and then transform into them. So there could be also sort of a stealth aspect.
Ooh.
Like if you ever, I don't know if either of you ever played Commandos. The computer game?
Not Commandos, no.
It's sort of a puzzle game about killing a lot of soldiers one at a time using stealth, mostly. One of the characters is the spy who can disguise as enemies and just walk through their camp in the open. So I'm imagining in an Animorphs game, you could all of your characters could just do that. They could transform into enemies and pretend to be them. And you have got like time limits built in, right? You can only stay in a morphed form for so long before you have to turn back. There's a ton of stuff you could play around with in an Animorphs XCOM game, I think.
Absolutely. I would absolutely play that game, 100%. I would not even... If I just saw it, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm buying that.
Yeah.
Yes. So are you joining me on the Animorphs IP?
I mean, I think I've talked myself into it, yeah.
Perfect,
I would absolutely do an Animorphs... a turn-based tactical combat game in the style of XCOM.
Perfect. Similar. Yeah, absolutely would play that. All right, just a quick question then from Rabid Angel as well. So, and this is for Charlie. He wants to know, who sings the octave up major third on the closing chord and what percussion instrument you pan around in the second line?
Oh, that's so specific. That's awesome.
I cannot answer that question.
Thomas?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Cool question, Thomas. I think I am doing that third harmony up high. The tabletop, take away.
Oh.
And percussion instrument, probably just... a random sound I found on my computer, but I'm glad you noticed the details of that. Yeah.
So then another question from him as well. Number one game you wish you had thought of.
Oh, that is... Oh, wait, is that easy? Well, okay, it's somewhat easy. There are whole lists of games that I wish I had thought of.
Yeah.
But I think the one that most comes to mind is probably Root. Because I've probably talked about this before, but back in college, I was really into Dune, the board game.
Yeah, yeah.
And I always thought, oh, well, the asymmetry is so cool in this game. I want to make a game like this with this sort of radical asymmetry, but I want it to be shorter. And so I tried a few different ideas, and they didn't work out very well. And then years later, when I encountered Root, I was like, okay, this is exactly what I was looking for. This is... radical asymmetry, but still accessible and but playable in a very short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So Root is basically exactly what I wanted to design back then when I was really into Dune. So that is, I would say, the number one game I wish I had thought of.
Mm. Good job, Leader Games.
Yeah. For me, I always respect like super simple games that are new, though. Like, so two that come to mind, So Clover.
Oh, yeah.
Just very clever. And Wavelength also, because, like, Wavelength has spawned a whole genre of games. Maybe, I don't know where Wavelength came from. Maybe there was something else before it. But, yeah, I've definitely used that mechanic in a game of mine, too.
Honestly, for me, I would go Mage Wars, which I only learned after Ananda taught me for this podcast, because it was such, like, it was exactly what I had wanted to make my RPG feel more like. And I was like, oh, my God, it's just all right here. How did they do that? Yeah, I would absolutely say Mage Wars. I probably would say another game if it were another day, but top of my head, absolutely Mage Wars. All right, if we could play some waiting music as I find the next one. Okay, so another from, I don't know if it's Tobias or Tobias. Tobias? Trevor Kirchner. I know who you are. okay, it's going to be a multi-part question, and it's about the podcast specifically.
Okay.
How would this show change if it was a video or live stream as opposed to just audio? And I'll ask the second question later.
If it was a video or live stream?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess...
You would be able to see what we were talking about, which is good.
We could point at things.
We could point at things. You could see cards we were referring to. On our end, it would change things substantially.
I think it would be more difficult for us, wouldn't
it?
As a video professional, there's a reason we've talked about it, and I've decided, like, I don't think it's worth the effort of getting two to three cameras set up so you can see the game. Like, the advantage is you can see the games we're talking about, which I was nervous about starting a podcast where we have to describe how the games work.
Yeah.
An audio podcast. Like, I didn't think that was a great idea to just, like, describe games, but actually I think it works decently. And the fact that we pick games that people have maybe played before, at least like half of them.
I haven't heard any complaints.
Yeah. So far, no complaints.
I haven't heard any complaints, but I have heard people that it would be great if we did have video.
If we did, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But
I think it would take a little hit on the audio end because we'd be like describing, we'd be like showing things and having to describe them.
And maybe that's a skill we could pick up as, you know, time goes on as well.
Also, if we became dependent on the video to support what we were saying, then people wouldn't be able to listen, you know, in the car or...
Yeah, so we would be less descriptive with the audio, and so you'd get less of the information if you're just listening to the audio.
Which means it wouldn't be as appealing to people who just want a podcast. You know, sometimes people don't want video.
Well, and a lot of people...
Some people might not want to see me in my pajamas. Because I could just wake up in my house and...
who knows?
Yep.
I will say, though, that, like, I've heard a lot of people listen to us when they're, you know, walking somewhere or driving somewhere. So normally in environments where they don't want to be watching a video as well. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of, you know, video content already out there for how to play these games. And so I think adding our, like, physical showing you it doesn't add as much to the community.
Yeah, this is not
a review.
A show. This is not a review. It's not a show where we explain how to play.
Yeah.
Those already exist.
Yeah. And they do a great job at that. And I wouldn't even want to try to compete with what they do.
Yeah. Because
they do great.
That's not what we're trying to do here.
So the answer is no.
So follow up. If the show was donated $1,000, what would you spend it on?
Well, in that case, let me tell you about how awesome it could be with video.
Oh, yeah. So video equipment is pretty neat.
I'm just kidding. Yeah.
What would we spend it on?
What would we spend it on?
Well, we have talked about that a little bit. Like, it's probably nice to have a game budget for the occasional game that we don't have.
Or don't have a friend who has. Or don't have a friend of a friend who has.
Yep.
Yep.
But I guess from a person who does a lot of, like, my own business stuff, I tend to undervalue my time sometimes. And maybe just paying ourselves to take the time to do the podcast might be a thing.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But
I had considered on my way here of us just like starting up a Patreon and just having a $1 pledge level. And if people want to join it, they can, but there's no additional things you get. Like, hey, support us doing the podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah. I suppose that's maybe not the most exciting pitch for donations. Yeah.
Donate now.
Yeah. But some people have asked about that. Yeah. And we've had a few nice donators. Yeah. So thank you.
Thank you.
But yeah, I think all of us came into it not expecting this to be like a business. So.
Yeah.
Right, right. We haven't sought any kind of marketing partners or anything like that.
And we don't want to.
Right.
We do not want advertising.
To keep it nice for you listeners to just...
Just wait for our games as they're released and we'll advertise those.
Yeah, 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 that's right.
I mean we do talk about our own games.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah.
So I guess probably not that much would change.
Yeah. But we appreciate the ask.
Yeah, we appreciate the thoughts.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, like if we had income coming in, maybe it would be something where we could put more time on it each week. And maybe we could release, you know, either bonus content or, you know, we could even start up a second thing called Rules and Rants that we joked about in the first several months of doing the podcast.
Yeah. Oh, so like you're saying like a faster release schedule.
Or just releasing other content as well.
Right.
In addition to our weekly episode. And so that's something I could see if we had a steady stream of income, I could see us putting aside more time to do it because then we wouldn't have to go find more money out there in the world.
Yeah. Well, here's what we could spend it on. Marketing.
Marketing for our Patreon.
Yeah. Well, well, just like already there's a lot of designers listening to this, which is awesome. But,
yeah.
You know, like it wouldn't – by spending some of that money on like either – some marketing in some way or like community buildings efforts,
yeah,
like then more people will get to listen.
That's very true.
So
just even getting the word out there, and then, you know, more people join the Discord, more people get engaged in the development process of game design and all that stuff. Like, yeah, we want to share the love more than anything, right? And I do not have a PhD in game design, so I am not trying to sell my knowledge. I like to talk about it though.
Yeah,
well,
that's.
at some point, I will be trying to sell my knowledge.
That's fine,
in book form.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's great.
Okay, so we're gonna do a light question, and then we'll probably be wrapping up here shortly. So the next question we have is from Harrison Dunn as well. If you could play test with any celebrity, who would it be? And I want to start off really quick, just because I had mine on lock. Deborah Ann Woll. Who is a professional DM and was in Daredevil, who played Karen, the TV show. I listened to her do a little stint with the actor who plays the Punisher. And she walked him through a brief D&D adventure and made up all of the roles that he would have been rolling as if it were just all a simulated experience just during their interview with each other. And I was like, oh, she's just really good at this. This is fantastic. So I'd love for her to play test Manifest because that would be phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess probably Eric Royce, Spirit Island designer. I've heard that he gives really great feedback in playtesting, so I think that would be pretty cool.
Awesome. Probably, I guess if we're talking designers, probably Richard Garfield. I mean, yeah, I really appreciate all his games.
Oh, what has he done? Sorry, I'll stop.
Well, people might not know.
That's true.
Magic the Gathering is his big one, but Netrunner, Keyforge, Robo Rally.
A lot of very large, very successful games.
Yeah.
Yep.
I don't know if any of my games are really actually in that his main style, but.
But maybe he really enjoys playing your style of games. He's just not a designer in that genre, you know?
Yeah.
All right, final question from Joe. How tall are you and why?
I mean, okay, I'm 6'1". As for why, I guess genetics and also good nutrition, very important.
I hear that is important
in childhood. Yeah. Genetics and nutrition.
I think the cereal I ate hampered my growth a little bit.
Oh. And I'm the shortest, probably 5'6", 5'7", around there.
Yeah, I'm marginally taller.
Yeah. And why? Yeah, my parents are both short. Good. What an amazing question.
What an amazing question.
Answer.
I am between 5'8 and 5'9, so my left leg is actually an inch shorter than my right. And that is because I had leg calf Perthes disease as a young kid, which stopped the growth in my left hip, so it couldn't grow much more, and it got deformed and all that good stuff.
Oh, no.
So this is really exciting to talk about, and I bet you didn't expect this answer.
No.
But in addition to that, I was anticipated to get to about 6 foot, 6 foot one, but yeah, I stopped at 5'8", 5'9", but my dad's 6'5", and my mom's 5'7", 5'6", 5'7", somewhere in there. So... yeah, I was supposed to be taller, but I came out 5'8 or so.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I think that covers it for our
question. That's the last question.
Yeah. Oh,
right.
We want to do another
one?
I think I might have one more.
Is there? We can
end on a funner note. Or let's see here.
Are we supposed to have takeaways for this episode? Or?
Takeaway. Listener questions are fun. We should do another episode sometime in the future.
Yeah, that seems like a fun way to engage with the community.
Mm-hmm.
We could interview other designers. Oh, wait, that's already done.
Well, yeah, we have... maybe listeners are wondering, will you ever have a guest designer on or to interview? And we've talked about it, but I think there are a lot of interview shows...
yeah.
For game design.
Mm-hmm.
So we've kind of just decided probably not because, having done an interview show on music, Composer Quest, I did that one. It takes a little more prep, a little more editing, everything else.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, it's cool to hear people's backgrounds, but if we were to have a guest designer on, I think I would just skip all that and be like, all right, let's just get down to the details. Let's talk about game design.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I'd interview him. I think I'd just invite him on to do what we do.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. Just have four of us instead of three.
Yeah.
Yep.
But, you know, that dynamic is something that we've picked up also by doing so many episodes together now.
Yeah.
And so, like, having a fourth person may actually be more difficult for us to have the same flow.
Yeah.
Which maybe I'm being pretentious a little bit.
Well,
but.
No, I think three people on a podcast is great because like if one person's zoning out, which sometimes happens.
Which happens regularly.
Then the other two can carry it. And
then they'll come back in and it's like, what were we talking? Oh, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Yep.
But I mean, even looking at shows like My Brother and Me, My Bim Bam, that is three people by and large.
Oh, yeah.
So like... I think it's a good model, especially when you don't have a lot of guests and stuff. If we did have guests, I'd think having one or two regular hosts would be better. But like, yeah, I think this is a great model for us.
Yeah. So I say all that about, yeah, who cares about people's backgrounds after we just did this whole 4-week series about asking us our own questions. But yeah, we hope you did enjoy it, though.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
It's fun for us and
helped us cover some episode gaps that we had in our catalog.
Yeah. Now we're back on track for sure. So look forward to a lot of fun episodes this summer.
Oh yeah.
Hey, thanks for listening to The Tabletop Takeaway. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. So please tell your friends and visit our website at thetabletoptakeaway.com, where you can suggest games and mechanics for us to cover next on the show.